Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Pardon Will podcast. I'm your host, David Lilly, a.k.a. Pardon Will. This week is going to be a great week. I have a guest I've been looking forward to having on. We're going to talk about all kinds of stuff, including Jesus, which I know you guys love that. But before we do that, if you like this podcast, and I know you do because you're watching it, and you want to support me, you can go to pardonwill.com and you can purchase this sweet book I just published like a month ago. It's titled By Every Meaningless Measure. It's art, it's poetry, it's all kinds of good stuff smashed together, an accumulation of my last decade of work. You can go to pardonwill.com and purchase that book, and I'll be like, hey, great podcast, keep it up, and you'll look smart, because it'll be in your bookshelf with all the other smart people. Just put me next to someone smart. Don't put me next to someone dumb in that bookshelf. Then it's just going to be like, this is where my dumb bookshelf goes. Don't do that. Put me next to like a Tolkien. That'd be awesome. Do that for me. I appreciate it. Like, subscribe, share this episode. You know, all the normal YouTuber stuff, all that good stuff. This week, I have a great pleasure to have on a guest. He's well known in the, his name is well known in the libertarian movement. He's been involved for quite some time. I've been paying attention to his work. One thing that caught me, just highlighted to me, is he is a fellow Christian. And he's in the liberty movement, which I tend to find myself in that as well. So me and him connect on a lot of grounds that way. He is the host of Biblical Anarchy podcast. He's also head of the Libertarian Christian Institute. And I think he's also pretty highly involved in the Christian Caucus and the libertarian movement. All these might be totally wrong. I'm going to have him correct me in just a minute. Without further ado, is my guest, Jacob Winograd. Jacob, did I do that right? Are you like, nope, not affiliated at all?
Like, all wrong. Actually, I'm a libertarian Satanist, and I'm here to talk about... No,
no, fix my notes real quick.
Yeah, right. Yeah, completely different conversation for you. You got that mostly right, except I am with the Libertarian Christian Institute, but I am not the head of it. The head of it is Norman Horn is the founder. Doug Stewart is the CEO, but I am one of our podcast hosts at the Libertarian Christian Institute, which our podcast feed is called the Christians for Liberty Network. But I am one of the co-founders of the Christian Caucus. So you got
awesome.
That right.
Okay, good. So I didn't mess up completely. Is there anything else I missed that you're like, no, I'm the head of this thing that
I don't know about? I mean, I've held a variety of different titles on and off in different, you know, groups. I mean, I've been the chair of county affiliates. I've also in the past been a state organizer for the Mises Caucus, but I'm not doing either of those things anymore. So, and I was the chair of the Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania's social media for about a year. So I got our, like, our, I mainly focused on Twitter and got us from like 3,000 followers to 5,000 followers. So
you didn't post anything controversial. You weren't doing anything like that.
nothing. Put it this way: the bar of what is controversial for a state affiliate in the Libertarian Party has been set so high that nothing by that high bar.
Well, you know what? Sky's the limit. Maybe one day you'll get close. Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that bar. I tend to call it the third rail.
Yes,
it's getting touched all the time when it comes to state affiliates in the Libertarian Party. Libertarians are a fun breed. I do want to find out, since you're a Christian and you're involved in all these Christian institutes and a libertarian, can you tell me when those two worlds collided for you? When you were like, hey, either you were a libertarian first and you were like, hey, I found this Jesus guy, seems pretty rad, or you were a Christian, you were like, hey, I found this libertarian movement, they're a little weird, but it seems to... Can you tell me when those two worlds met?
Yeah, so I started out in politics from the left. I was raised in the church. Actually, I was a pastor's kid. And I never lost my faith, but I definitely had more of a progressive sort of like counter evangelical theology for a while, probably from the time I left high school till coincidentally around the time I became a libertarian. So even though I was raised a Christian, I would say that my faith matured right around the same time that I started going through a little bit of a political evolution, because so I was like a Bernie Sanders Democrat, essentially.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, you know, like guys like Glenn Greenwald and
Matt Taibbi, that kind of
That kind of thing, that kind of lefty. So I was always
Bernie bro.
Bernie bro. I was predominantly motivated to be on the left because I was anti-war. I had discovered a lot of the propaganda around 9/11 and around the war in Iraq when I was in high school, because I was very into politics. I was on our speech and debate team. I was actually the captain of my speech and debate team my senior year. Nice. Led us to a district championship. And kind of being political. This was like 2008 to 2011. So so it was around the years of Ron Paul, but I just didn't get, you know, enough exposure to Ron Paul. But I was definitely, you know, very caught up in, you know, kind of, I think a lot of people then were talking about the war in Iraq and how it was clear we had been lied into it. I had, you know, my history teacher was a kind of a based progressive, and so like in my AP history class, he taught us a lot about the American foreign policy in the 80s and 90s and things like that, because he was very well versed on that. You know, I remember reading Bin Laden's Declaration of War and stuff, and so yeah, like a lot of the stuff that you'll hear, you know anti-war libertarians like Dave Smith or Scott Horton or whatnot talk about, like I remember, you know, reading that stuff in high school, and it just completely radicalizing me against imperialism, radicalizing me against the military industrial complex, and I didn't understand economics, so I found myself on the left. But then after
And I didn't understand economics, so it makes sense that I'd be...
Right, exactly. I mean, if you're anti-war and you don't understand economics, then, I mean,
there's you end up... place for you.
Yep. Right, exactly. And I started questioning my sort of like progressive identity after Trump, because Trump broke the left and really fractured. And plus, like Bernie Sanders getting really screwed in the Democratic primary, it was like I was already like on the Democratic Party. I didn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton, but so funny story.
I voted apparently
for Hillary Clinton because, and this will make a lot of people groan, because Bill Weld endorsed her.
Oh, really?
Because I was actually looking at Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, because I was like, I really don't want to vote for Gary Johnson. I didn't really like the Green Party, and I was like, you know, I was seeing ads and seeing, you know, TV exposure of Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, and my dad was saying that's who he was going to vote for. So I was like looking into it, but then when I saw them like saying, you know, Hillary Clinton's a good person and we disagree, I was like, okay, I don't know, maybe I'm, you know, overreacting here. I guess I'll vote for Hillary Clinton, which I, you know,
man, you wear that like a badge of honor. I would have been like, I'm just never gonna bring. I didn't even vote that.
Well, I bring that up more because I know a lot of people bring up how Bill Weld endorsed Hillary and how that was such a just a complete failure in terms of like political strategy for a libertarian. And I bring that up because like it was, because there were a lot of people on the left who probably would have been more drawn towards libertarianism if someone had gone up there and answered that question by going, no, this woman's a warmonger and she's corrupt and evil, and here are the reasons why you should vote libertarian. I could have been a libertarian a lot sooner had someone actually made that case, but they didn't. Well, but anyway, after the left went insane, I kind of, you know, left my progressive circles and I started listening to more, you know, right of center voices, and just happened to find myself down a podcast trail after watching a Dave Smith debate with Sam Cedar, and found Tom Woods.
I've seen that debate.
I found the Mises Institute. I found Bob Murphy and all that, and started learning economics. And so I quickly became a libertarian after that. I didn't become an ANCAP or an anarchist until a little bit after that. It was like 2018. And then after I became an anarchist and you know, full Rothbardian anarcho-capitalism, I kind of was like, I want to see, and I had this intuition. I was like, I couldn't put into words. I was like, I feel like my knowledge of the Bible and just and just there's themes that I can see in the Bible that I think correlate with this political rabbit hole I've fallen into. And so I kind of spent a couple years diving deep into that, which actually led me on a theological journey where I went on complete opposite end. And so instead of being a more progressive Christian, my theology, I kind of went more fundamentalist. I'm more like a Reformed Baptist now. And yeah, so then I started podcasting like in 2020. It was originally the Daniel 3 podcast, and then I changed it to the Biblical Anarchy podcast and joined the Libertarian Christian Institute about a year and a half ago. So cool. That's a long story, as short as I can make it, because as you know, with podcasters, we take 30-second answers and we draw them out for as long as we can.
That's your job, right? And that's yeah. That's what I was told. I was like, hey, stop going like, so
can
fast.
Can you take 10 seconds of material and stretch it out over an hour? It's like, you bet I can. you bet I can.
Did you say one or did you say three? Because I can do three. Right? No, man, I appreciate that. I like to hear interesting from people that come. Honestly, you had me at the, I learned economics and that came from the left. Just so you know where I'm, I didn't actually come that far from the left. I was, lo and behold, a pastor's kid as well. So I grew up in the church, but I went through a hardcore punk rock phase. And so all during the Bush years, I was in punk bands and I didn't know anything about politics. I just knew this was kind of my flavor, you know, like these are war crimes. And I kind of understood the political realm in the punk rock era. But I didn't get really political till 2018. I think it was the first time I voted. I did nothing but theology stuff. I was involved in ministry, church planting, and I just studied and read a bunch of theology stuff. And then I found out about 2016, when Trump got elected, I realized that no one wanted to really talk about religion anymore. I used to have conversations, a lot of my friends were atheists. We would have conversations all the time about religion and God and Jesus. And then all of a sudden it was that conversation went out the window. It was nothing but politics. And then everything became political. And so then I found myself, I was like, well, if I studied all of these other religions and started to kind of try to, you know, build the bridges between Christianity and Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam, and kind of figure out where they're coming from so I can, you know, give an answer or at least understand it better to make sure I realized that the new religion was politics. And so that's when I started to get involved. I still don't know anything about economics. I just steered away from the left somehow. I think it was my biblical background. I have a question. So here lately, this issue, and I've spoken to you before, but this issue of Christian nationalism has come up on the internet a lot. And so for those who aren't, I mean, this podcast is on the internet, so obviously we're talking to people who are aware, most likely. But I refrained from bringing this topic up even on my own podcast till I caught a clip, and I brought up this last one. I caught a clip of Morning Joe with Mr. Joe Scarborough, astute scholar Scarborough, and his co-host was talking about Trump and selling a Bible, and she mentioned the Christian nationalism. And I was like, this word, and I think they came out with a book, it keeps being brought up in like NBC and CNN. They're talking about it. So I know it's not just the Twitter sphere. Can you tell me what your thoughts are on the term Christian nationalism? And I'll bring that closer into a better question. Do you think it's a political movement or a cultural movement, or maybe both?
Yeah, it's
fine. I guess that's probably a better question.
So, I mean, Christian nationalism is sort of a mixture of different things. There are definitely a lot of people who would say that they are Christian nationalists who are playing a game that is not particularly political, although that has political implications. You know, you could say there's like soft Christian nationalism where the basic framing would be that, well, we basically need to just reinstitute Christianity as the driving force in our country, and we need to be a Christian nation, and the only way the Constitution works, the only way that you know, limited government can work, the only way that, you know, we can have a functioning society is you know, one based, you know, on a people that is primarily Christian. And so there's a lot of people who use the term more or less in that way. And that's a spectrum. So then you can go from there all the way to another end where you have people like Nick Fuentes who are going to say, well, we need blasphemy laws, and we need anti-sodomy laws, and we Sabbath laws, and, you know, basically, you know, Christianity needs to be enshrined in the, you know, in the law.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole lot of different, you know, grades or variants in between there. Back when I was at Freedom Fest with the Libertarian Christian Institute last year, that was in Memphis in July, we were largely talking about Christian nationalism in response to a book that came out. This was by Stephen Wolfe. He wrote the book called A Case for Christian Nationalism, which was published by Canon Press, which is associated with Doug Wilson, who is pretty big in the Reformed world. And so, you know, that book puts forth a sort of case for Christian nationalism that I would say is kind of a somewhere in the middle. And that's where a lot of Christian nationalism seems to be today. I would say most Christian nationalists are not full-blown Nick Fuentes, but they're usually, there's a bit of a Mott and Bailey approach here, where a lot of times they, the leading pitch is, well, you know, nationalism is just a nation and we want people to be Christian. So, you know, we just want to have a Christian nation, right? And that's kind of how they reel people in. And then they start asking questions like, well, I mean, come on. Like, it just, it's not unreasonable to say, like, you know, people shouldn't be allowed to say totally blasphemous things in the public square and not, you know, have some kind of consequence for it. Or it's not that big of a deal to have laws, you know, enforcing the Sabbath and only certain business. You know, it's like they kind of do this sort of like mission creep, where they keep adding more things to what, you know, and so people will get caught, dragged into this, and then kind of like the frog in boiling water, not realize how much authoritarianism is creeping into their politics and ideology. And I would say it's largely been alluring to a lot of Christians and even a lot of conservatives who I think are more or less LARPing as Christians, or they're like cultural Christians, not what I would call like a, you know,
cultural Christian. You mean like Richard Dawkins?
Exactly. I was actually just listening to that clip today.
Right. Yeah.
You know, varying degrees of that. But yeah, so, you know, and people are, I think, allured to this because they see the excesses of the left and they feel like, well, in order to combat this growing kind of woke progressive mob, you know, we need to have a basically counter collectivism. And I've had actually people will use that term. It's like, we're going to have collectivism, we're going to have authoritarianism, we're going to have tyranny. And so we have a choice. Those things can be driven by a progressive secular ideology, or they can be driven by a Christian nationalist ideology. So I'd say it's a good enough, you know, overview or summary of what Christian nationalism is. It's not like one thing. There's like an overarching, you know, sort of thing there, which is basically like, you know, pushing Christian beliefs into politics to some degree and trying to make a national identity around Christianity. But that bears out in different, you know, different shades, different extremes.
I think what you said is spot, at least from what I can see. I think the that kind of tit for tat, it's either them or us. Either the progressives are gonna, you know, mandatory that all, you know, Christians be locked up in a room and, you know, mandatory drag shows for all the kids. You have to make your kids go to it and cut their genitals off because we said so. Or we're gonna steal them from you and CPS is gonna come, and that whole thing has scared people. And what this particular group is coming out going, well, if they're gonna do it, we're gonna do it even harder and go back to the basics. I think that pendulum swing thing can catch a lot of people. But I have a hard time believing that it catches actual Christians. Where do you think the Christian, like, we need a Christian nation, that line for an actual, say, you know, just a normal Christian, they're like, hey, don't you want prayers back in school? We're like, yeah, I would love that. Wouldn't you want a Christian president who, you know, believes in Jesus? We're like, yeah, well, I want that, Jacob. I want these things. Where is the line when they start to take the train off the tracks and be like, you want the Crusades again? You're like, well, hold on, back up, dude. Where is that line, do you think, that where a normal Christian hits a wall and like, oh, this is starting to turn like a cult? Where do you think that line is?
So I don't know where I would draw the line in terms of a specific issue, but on a doctrinal level, the line would be when they distort what I would say is the biblical view of civil governance.
Okay.
And so I believe, and people might be confused when I say, you know, I'm a, you know, biblical anarchy, and some people will need to be reminded, or people who are unfamiliar with anarchy will just need to have a quick lesson here.
Let's
that
do it.
Governance is not a synonym for the state or for statism. And so we can have governance, which would be the administration of law. And, you know, there's a saying that anarchy does not mean no rules. It just means no rulers. And so what anarchism, you know, which I think is the fullest expression of libertarianism, but what it ultimately is at the end of the day is the belief that the enforcement of law, the enforcement of, you know, the non-aggression principle or of property rights needs to be done in a way that is consistent within its own legal framework, meaning that we cannot violate the law that we are trying to enforce in en route to enforcing it. And the problem with a state is that it is the introduction of a monopoly of force that is created through the initiation of violence and without consent, without obeying proper, you know, legal norms of property and contract and voluntary arrangement. And so, you know, now I could back off of that and even, you know, try to put on a minarchist hat and say that at the very least, a biblical view of civil governance could even involve like a minimal state or a night watchman state. But at the end of the day, whoever is in authority is only given that authority by God to administer very specific things. And they are there to protect the innocent and to carry out justice against the evildoer. Now, people who are in the Christian nationalist camp, people who are in tangential camps like theonomists and whatnot, will take that, like say from Romans 13, and say, well, they're there to punish evil, so that means any and all evil, and so that means, you know, any sin. I'm like, well, first of all, we don't see that bearing out in Scripture. We don't see where Jesus is teaching that we need to use violence against people who have committed any sin. We don't see that in the apostles and the way that they conduct the affairs of their church. The most, you know, severe punishment for unrepentant sin is just to ostracize them from the church, right? And from, yeah, you know, their community, but not to, you know, initiate force and violence against them. Even in the Mosaic Law, it was there were certain things that could be enforced, but that was only ever for the Jewish people. There was never any mandate that said, well, now we need to expand this to the Gentiles and to, you know, to other nations. And so rather what we actually would have to understand is that because of the passing of the Old Covenant, which was like a eschatological intrusion into natural law, we're back to natural law, which was established in Genesis. If by a man blood is shed, then by a man shall his blood be shed. So it's basically saying, like, you know, if aggression is initiated, then defensive or retaliatory aggression is warranted. And if we're talking about civil authorities, then, well, then their jurisdiction is necessarily limited to civil matters.
Right.
Just like the church authority would be necessarily delegated to church matters, and parental authority is necessarily relegated to parental matters. Church doctrine or like theological systems can come into play here, although they're not explicitly from the Bible. They're derived from biblical principles. So two of my favorite doctrines are the doctrine of the lesser magistrate, okay, and the doctrine of sphere sovereignty, which comes from the Dutch Reformed tradition.
Yeah.
The doctrine of the lesser magistrate, just to sum it up, says that anything that should be enforced through civil authority should be done by the most local level possible. And then sphere sovereignty is the idea that different types of authority and different types of like society exist in different spheres. You have like the sphere of the church, you have the sphere of you know, like business, you have the sphere of the family. And although these spheres interact with each other and touch, they don't consume one another or override. Like, for example, church authority does not step into matters that are, you know, delegated to parental authority, mm-hmm. right? So, like, my pastor has authority over things I do in church matters. Like, if I am serving in a church capacity, he can direct me as to what to do on church property. There can even be like spiritual authority between Christians. He can speak into my marriage, speak into my life as I grant him that. But he can't be like, all right, you need to put your kids to bed at 7:30 and right. you can't let them watch these certain shows and yeah. you need to feed them this certain food or you need to take them to this particular, like that would be a misuse of his authority because it overstepped his sphere. In the same way, civil authority is relegated to civil matters. And so that's what Christian nationalists and similar types are missing when they're reading Romans 13. Romans 13 does say that God institutes authority, and there's all different types of authority. But if we're talking about civil authority, that means, as described by Romans 13, that they are prescribed to wield the sword to punish evildoers, but they are not a terror to good works. And again, in the civil sense, to do good means that you're not violating anyone's rights. Yeah. So therefore, we can conclude that there are a lot of things that may or may not be useful or correct to delegate to civil authority, but the clear line is that the civil authority, no matter if that's a minarchist state or I would prefer it as a polycentric legal order in sort of like anarcho-capitalist fashion. But they're never prescribed by God to have authority to use in pursuit of cracking down with force against people who have not committed any sort of civil crime. And so that's where you have to, you know, Christian nationalists might have different issues where they cross that line. I wouldn't say there's one particular issue where they always cross it, but the minute they are saying we need to use the sword of the civil magistrate to crack down on people who have not violated anyone else's property rights, who have not initiated force against anyone, and not in the enforcement of some kind of, you know, voluntary agreement or contract, that is where the line is being crossed. You know, there are certain things where there might be some gray area, like, you know, if a local community wants to have Sabbath laws, there might be a way to do that in a way that doesn't initiate force. And so this gets into, you know, like different ways of prescribing different rules and whatnot. But the minute
that not be again, like a social credit score, but like, dude, you missed church, you only get one slice of bread this week, you know.
Yeah, it could be more like financial incentives or things like that. But put it this way, what we have to do, and this is something libertarians are good at and Christians need to get better at, is stripping away language designed to obfuscate reality.
You're right.
The state is sort of a fictitious entity, and it's a shorthand that really describes a group of people.
Yeah.
And so anytime we are, and listen, I'm all for law, right? So law is basically that which comes into play when there is conflict and enforces what is just. You know, we try to find a just outcome to the conflict. If, you know, someone is trying to burn your house down, well, then it is obviously within, you know, Christian and libertarian, you know, legal theory to say that you are warranted in having a law that would say that they're not allowed to do that, which means you can enforce that law through force, which means that so if someone's trying to burn your house down, then you with a gun or men with guns are justified in preventing that or responding to stop them and to subdue them. Yeah, that's what the law is. The law is basically whatever you would justify the use of force or pointing a gun at someone to compel them to do. I would use force to compel someone to not burn my house down. But you will not find any biblical standard that says that we should point a gun at someone because they decided to, you know, keep their bakery open on the Sabbath, or because they took the Lord's name in vain, or even if they're in a sexual relationship that goes outside of what is considered moral by biblical standards, so long as it's between consenting adults. I mean, outside of consenting adults, we always have the wood chipper, as libertarians like to talk about, and that's different because that violates consent, and that, you know, the thing I'm referencing here, and
libertarians have the wood chipper. The Christians have prolonged baptism, where you just go under and you just don't let them back.
Right.
That's so, the Christian version of the wood
chipper. So if someone comes after your kids, you know, like, so there are sexual relationships where, or sexual activities that violate consent, that are aggression. But if it's two consenting adults engaging in behavior that, you know, by biblical standards are sinful, the civil authority doesn't have anything to say about that. Church authority has something to say about that. The moral law of God has something to say about that. But those are matters for God to judge, and matters for, if they're in church, for the church to have a say on, but not matters where we should be prescribing men with guns to come in and use force to compel a change in behavior.
Well, I mean, going back to, like, if someone's standing outside, this is where people get caught up, right? They get caught up in a little bit of the fanatical. Is when this conversation, if someone's outside my house trying to burn it down, I technically have the right and justified in stopping that person by what means of force that I deem is necessary. And then the Christian nationalists will come to you and be like, dude, they're burning our country down, in some cases, literally. And then you go, okay, well, no, maybe we do need a force. But even all of the things that you described, well, even these social, like, local things, we're like, well, Sabbath laws, how would that work? Would there be incentivization? We're already seeing that on a secular scale on the flip reverse. And then you have, like, hate speech laws, hate crime laws. I haven't figured out what hate speech is, technically. I don't even think we've defined it. We're not defining these terms. We're just slapping things on top of them, of being like, well, we don't know what hate speech is, but this is how much you're going to have to pay, or you're going to jail for this much time.
But as much as you can't define hate speech, how can you define blasphemy laws? Because blasphemy, by whose standard?
Exactly.
Is it the Baptist standard, or is it the Catholic standard?
Yeah.
Or is it the Eastern Orthodox standard? Or is it the Charismatic Episcopalian churches? I mean, there's
that
so many
awful.
Different.
Yeah. Yeah. If you say you're going straight to the jail. Straight to
right,
jail.
Right. Right. So I mean, you know, there's no consistent standard by which we can define what is or isn't blasphemy. Just like we can't define what is or isn't hate speech. And they would say they're burning our country down. This is again where language is being used to obfuscate reality.
But in some cases, they literally were. Which in that case you would have a right to.
So I agree, right? But so what we have to get away from as Christians is the use of collective punishment and collective language that instead should be replaced with judging individuals for individual actions. So if you see people rioting in your streets and burning businesses down, use the appropriate amount of force to subdue them. And by appropriate, I mean, like, yeah, you can use men with guns. I wouldn't, to make a comparison, because I think it's useful to draw this comparison. You could describe the rioters as a sort of domestic terrorist, right? What other nation states do in pursuit of sort of like domestic or local terrorists is bomb entire city blocks down. I wouldn't authorize that. So there is a limit to how much you can't in your response create more victims. The collateral damage isn't something that the Christian should find acceptable, but using the correct precise amount of, you know, strategic force to subdue people who are rioting and burning down property and threatening people's lives, that's just. If it's people who are just promoting an ideology that you disagree with, that is not something that, you know, I mean, that it might be a harmful ideology, and it should be something we push back on and correct in the public square, but it's not something that private actors or civil authorities would have any moral right to use force to stop. Yeah. And even if, you know, I mean, I would say a secondary argument would be like, you know, this is a classic libertarian critique is, you know, the power you grant the state to wield against your enemies will tomorrow be wielded by your enemies against you.
Yeah.
But you know, even if somehow you could argue away some way you could keep the power and not have it be rustled away from you, which good luck with that. Yeah. But even if you could, you still wouldn't be morally justified in doing so. There's nothing about some, you know, someone just uttering words that, I mean, unless the words are like threatening, like I'm going to kill you. Like, so I guess, you know, the Christian nationalists will try to, like you said, they'll try to push that and be like, oh, well, if they're promoting, you know, transgenderism for kids, they're promoting violence. And I mean, to some extent, I understand where they're coming from.
I mean, that's not, you could draw those lines and not have to go very far to draw them. And I think,
right.
Like it's, and that's kind of where I get to this, because what I'm trying to figure out, and we'll go to, what I'm trying to figure out is how, because I'm watching it in real time where Christians are falling into a little bit here and a little bit more and a little bit more, and kind of understand the pendulum swing, and rightfully so. What gets me is the dividing line of going, okay, this is within the Christian realm, this is within a political run, and there is a line between being a Christian and being a Christian nationalist, and that line, I would say it's a little bit more in depth than just the NAP, right? I would say it has to be a theological doctrine on it. There is an aspect, this is why I like Christianity and libertarianism, is libertarians are very much involved in a volunteerism of all things. And I think Christianity at its core is voluntary, like at its basic core. It's just not compulsive. And I think what confuses me, and this is a side note, if Christian nationalism, if I take it at a face value, like blur it a little bit, I might not be able to tell you the difference between it and Islam, or at least the radical, you know, faction of Islam. And I'm not sure if people notice that if you blur it just a little bit, you would not be able to tell the difference. And that's what I'm saying. Like, there is a dividing. You can't tell me Christianity and Islam are the same. So what's that defining line?
Yeah. And I would say that the dividing lines between Islam and Christianity are one that Islam is much more explicitly a conquering religion, and historically so, and not to say that all Muslims are advocating
canceled. No, I'm
not to say that all Muslims are saying, well, we should go conquer other nations and whatnot, but their religion, I would say, to a greater extent than Christianity or Judaism, doesn't have the same moral substrate built into it in terms of you know, not using force to achieve ends, even political ends. You know, I think, you know, the biblical narrative of a whole as a whole is very interesting. You have in the beginning of the nation of Israel, after God made covenant with them, rescued them out of Egypt, brought them to the promised land, they lived in an essential state of like a libertarian theocracy, where they had their you know, religious law and religious leaders that they submitted to, which was their way of submitting to God. But then the tribes kind of governed themselves, and when disputes and conflicts broke out, local judges would be, you know, appointed and raised up to solve those disputes. But the book of Judges is like a 300-400 year period, and there were stretches of, like, you know, 50 years here, 80 years there of peace in between certain conflicts, which, you know, I think is relatively good, all things considered.
Awesome. That's normal.
People sometimes try to depict libertarianism, anarchism as a utopian vision. I'm like, no, I think it's rather just the saying that the status quo of humans being fallen is going to suck. But I think that the introduction of the state makes things worse and not better, which is exactly what happened to Israel. Because in 1 Samuel 8, the Israelites gather to Samuel and they go, we're tired of this. Like your children don't follow in your footsteps. They're not following God. And we keep on having to solve all these conflicts ourselves and have these judges fix things for us. And the other nations don't have this. These other nations have kings, and the kings run everything. The kings take care of that. So Israel stopped looking to God to solve their problems, and they start looking to the world to solve their problems, and the world solves their problems through, we erect a strong man in this kingdom, and this earthly kingdom and this earthly king go out and, you know, basically solve all our problems for us. And God tells Samuel to warn them, like, you don't want this, because not, first of all, you're rejecting me as your king, just as you have worshipped golden calves and idols, you know, after I rescued out of Egypt. This is the same thing. Then also, this king that you want is going to take the best of your fields, the best of your livestock for him. He's going to take your children and make your children fight on the front lines of his wars, and you will be his slaves.
It sounds so familiar. I have no idea what this is. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's a good thing we don't live under anything like that right now.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So Israelites don't heed the warning. They get a king, and yeah, things, I mean, even under King David, David leads them into sin. Yeah. Saul's obviously a disaster. Solomon starts out okay, and then it's a disaster. And most of the kings, like three quarters of them, you know, lead the nation into idolatry and into sin and away from God. You know, there's points of time after the institution of the monarchy where, like, there's only one person who's really following after God, right? Like one point, like Elijah's like by himself.
It's so true, right.
The point I'm trying to make here is like walking through biblical history here is that going back to the beginning, we see that even when a state was instituted, it wasn't a good thing. And then God was like, all right, fine, we'll try to make this good. Like, God gave them provisions for how the king's supposed to act. But he didn't do it. He gave them laws that were supposed to, they were supposed to obey the laws, and it was supposed to make them better. It was supposed to perfect them. It was supposed to make them righteous. In Exodus, he called them to be a royal priesthood, but they failed. Then we get to Jeremiah, and God says in like chapter, I forget the exact, somewhere in 31 or 32, that, you know, speaking of the Jewish people, that they have broken the covenant. They have turned their back on me. But he said, but this isn't the end. I am going to make a new covenant. And that's where Jesus comes in.
Yep.
And Jesus in his new covenant is the new Israel, according to Galatians, and it succeeds where Israel fails. But then what is the example that Jesus gives us? Jesus doesn't come and institute another kingdom. He says, my kingdom is not of this world. He says, if you want to be the greatest among you, you must become the least. If you want to be the leader, you must be a servant. You must become a servant to all, just as I have come to be, not to be served, but to serve. He literally tells the apostles not to be archists. He says, don't be like the Gentiles. This is Mark 10:42. Don't seek to be like the Gentiles who want to seek positions of power to rule over one another, but rather you must serve one another. Jesus doesn't come to conquer, to conquer people. Rather, he comes to conquer sin and death and to set people free from the bondage of sin and death. And then his kingdom is not based on power and tyranny and compelling people to do what is right. Rather, it is based on the Spirit and based on servant-like leadership and based on leading people through your acts of service. And so we don't get, you know, that's Christianity, right? That's like the biblical narrative summarized. And I don't see where you can get from that the, you know, a prescription of, you know what, when the Jews tried to use the state to institute righteousness, it totally, utterly failed. But if we do it, it'll work this time.
Yeah, the thing that throws me off, it's not as if we can't even look back in history. And this is the kind of thing that irritates me. You know that that meme where it's like, well, real communism's never been tried,
right?
Yeah. I think about that with these Christian nationalists who are like, well, you know, we need a Christian nation. I was like, bro, we had that, and you remember how that went? Like,
we had several,
but real Christianity nationalism has never been tried. Like, and that's that was initially my response to this idea. Number one, I think, and me and my pastor ministry friends, we always get in this a bit. It's not a debate. it's a bit of a topic discussion of whether or not it's beneficial that we have so many denominations, especially in a Protestant realm, versus having like a Catholic church with bishops and a hierarchy. And I have conversations with Catholics all the time about how they're like, this is way better. You Protestants have weird stuff going on over there. But at the same time, I almost feel as if that's a divine providence that we have so many denominations, because if you were to do something like Christian nationalism, this division between most Protestants and this, it would only work if it was Catholic. You could never have, I mean, you could try to do a council, be like, well, we have a council of the, you know, the Anglicans, the Lutherans, the SBC. And then if you did do a council, it'd just be Nicaea all over again. Not much would get done without somebody getting punched at one point in time. And so I think it's a God bless thing that we have denominations in different flavors. But going back to the Christian nationalism thing, it's not as if we don't know where this leads down to. That's number one. And the other thing that I think is, this is the part that makes me the most nervous. And this is why because I try not to do this because there's not a lot of Christians out there, but I question their belief in some aspects when it comes to this hardcore Nick Fuentes Christian nationalism, because it almost as if they don't care as much about people being saved, but more about clean roads and tidy schools. And I'm like, well, if you do have, you know, if the trains do run on time, Nick, how many people are just going to never even meet Christ, but the streets will be clean? Like, what kind of message would that be? It was like, well, we'll have people coming to Jesus all the time through what? Like, through what? That's my point, is the focus is not on the gospel or the kingdom to come. It's right. We need to make the kingdom right now. And if we have this right now, then what? People are going to be saved? I don't understand how you take America being hardcore Christian and the salvation of souls. Now, maybe, again, the streets might be cleaned, but I don't know where the salvation of souls enters into that. Can you help me with that one? Or am I just...
No, I mean, I think you're spot on. I don't know, you know. So Stephen Wolfe tries to put it this way. He basically, and it's weird because Stephen Wolfe is Reformed, which I am, you know, loosely Reformed. And so, like, the Reformed tradition would say that God has total sovereignty over who is saved.
Yeah.
So it makes no sense for me to be like, for Stephen Wolfe to make this argument. But he basically, what he tries to do, and I think other Christian nationalists do this in, you know, they don't always come from the Reformed tradition, but a lot of the Christian nationalists, by the way, they tend to be either Reformed or they tend to be ultra Orthodox or Catholic.
I've noticed the same thing. You know where the Christian the evangelicals are too far out there for them to really participate in this. I think the evangelicals are getting caught up in something that they're not quite there. Continue. Sorry, I interrupted. I've noticed the same thing. Orthodox, Catholic, or Reformed. I always keep my eye on those three. I'm a Reformed Pentecostal. I'm about in that tier. I'm about four wings of the tulip. I can't really commit to all of it. So it's anyway.
Mean, it's like, you know, and just to describe where I'm at, it's like I'm Reformed in a sense of like I find myself in that camp, but I tend not to be very dogmatic or partisan in my, you know, in my beliefs, but I generally affirm God's sovereignty in salvation, that grace is a gift from God, freely given, not something that we earn. You know, tulip, I mean, it can be useful. It's not necessarily a dogma that I would ascribe.
But I find myself in those camps all the time. I just normally don't stick around long because those are awful parties. They're terrible parties.
So Calvinists are a lot like objectivists, where it'll be like, hey, I like Calvinism. I don't like a lot of Calvinists. Yeah, like, exactly. I like objectivism. I like Ayn Rand. I don't like a lot of Randians and objectivists. Yeah. Of course, I do love that there are good Reformed people out there. Like, I love my cohorts at LCI, Greg Bouse and Gary Baldwin. They're Reformed like me. They're actually the host of what's called the Reformed Libertarian podcast. And I think the three of us do a very good job at honoring what I would say is the true Reformed traditions. I don't think it's anything wrong with Reformed theology, to be clear. I think the problem is more that a lot of people only study certain kind of niche aspects of Reformed theology and then mix in a lot of worldly stuff and a lot of their own kind of like esoteric specific readings to kind of promote, you know, distortions of what I would say is true Reformed theology. But so, like, people like Stephen Wolfe will say we need to use the state almost like a sacrament. is basically what they're saying, is that in the same way that like the Lutherans would say that baptism is like a means of grace, yeah. That basically like we need to use the state and the law to create the conditions that incentivize Christian-like behavior and Christian-like values. And through people being incentivized to act that way, this will, you know, usher in God using this environment to save more souls. And I just find that to be a very
super strange coming from a Reformed.
It's very strange coming from, I mean, I'm using the term Reformed
yeah,
a little loosely here. I mean, he uses the title to describe himself, but I mean, put it this way. He opens up the book by saying, I'm not going to do any scriptural exegesis in this book. And I'm just
this doesn't sound like a Reformed.
I was like, what?
Wait, what? Hey, can I ask you a question? I ask you a question about this? Because I didn't read Stephen Wolfe, but I did hear about him through a James Lindsay podcast. The Stephen Wolfe guy, what do you think he wants out of all? You read the book, you kind of understand where he's coming from. What do you think is his end game? Is he grifting? Is he just trying to spark something? Does he think he's going to be renowned? He's going to be up on the bookshelves next to, you know, Bart and Chesterton or whatever. What do you think he's after?
So, I mean, I've read his book. I've listened to a couple of his interviews. I can't say I know his heart or mind and what his goals are. To be charitable, Stephen Wolfe and other Christian nationalists and theonomists can sometimes be fellow travelers in certain regards. So, like, there are certain things where Stephen Wolfe and I and other Christian nationalists will find ourselves on the same side of an issue. For example, we are all united in sort of like anti-interventionism, and even some of them would go as far as to say they're anti-war.
Yeah.
So, and Stephen Wolfe's in that camp. He actually describes himself as like a paleo conservative, they're very, you know, very much like Pat Buchanan and whatnot. A lot of paleo conservatives. We're kind of aligned with libertarians back in the day. People like Tucker Carlson today are kind of like a modern revival of paleo conservatives. Not to say that I agree with them on everything, but like that's one area of sometimes, you know, kind of loose agreement. I think ultimately what Stephen Wolfe wants for himself, I think he's, as far as I can tell, I think that he thinks he's honestly wrestling with these ideas, because he says, well, Christian nationalism is being used as this sort of like that, like the left started using it first and like using it as a pejorative. And he's like, well, is it a pejorative? Maybe we should just embrace this. Yeah. And then maybe we should actually rethink this. And so, you know, I think I'll give a charitable interpretation of Stephen Wolfe, because I would want him to give a charitable interpretation of me. I can't read his mind or heart. He can't read mine. If there's more nefarious things going on there, that's between him and God. But to give him charity as a professing believer, even though I've been very critical of some of his views, I think from what I remember of his book, he's saying that Christians are being pushed, you know, having pejoratives being thrown at us and being bullied, and that a lot of evangelicals, a lot of Christians, a lot of Protestants have been content to sort of like take a back seat in society and to let secular people and secular powers take over institutions, take over the culture, and Christians have basically said, well, we should turn the other cheek to this and just kind of let it happen. Doesn't matter how bad things get. We can't fight back. That's not the Christian way. And Stephen Wolfe is more or less convicted to say this is wrong, that Christians should have an active role in shaping the world. And this would be another area, just like the anti-interventionism. This would be like an area of like where I would say, well, I agree with that sentiment.
Right.
Where he goes wrong, I think, is in the prescription of what does it look like to transform the world. So like, listen, I just finished this book. It's Engaging the World with Abraham Kuyper. So within the Reformed tradition, you have the Dutch reformers and Abraham Kuyper being kind of like the head of that. So you have Kuyperianism, which is also sometimes called
ism for friggin' everything. There's always an ism. One day, right. I hope I have an ism on the end of my name. And
right.
I hope
yeah.
it's not something awful. Watch it be something awful. Be like McCarthyism. It'll be used as a pejorative. Be like that Lilyism, and be like, oh no, God, no, not Lilyism. One day. But yeah, sorry, continue.
No.
Kuiperism.
Yeah, Kuiperianism, which is also sometimes called, it's a contrast to like the Two Kingdoms view. Two Kingdoms okay, theology kind of comes, I think, from Luther. And I'm not like an expert on the history of Two Kingdoms, but in terms of what Two Kingdoms says, it basically would say that we have dual citizenship. That we are kingdom, we are citizens of the kingdom of heaven, but that we also are citizens of the king of the nations we find ourselves in, and we have this dual citizenship, this kind of dual loyalty, and we submit to these kingdoms and should obey their laws and not cause any trouble, and just kind of view ourselves as like exiles in this foreign world, and just kind of like, you know, the world does its thing and builds its kingdoms, and we live in them and we participate in them, but then we also do our Christian thing in our churches and whatnot. But that these two are kind of mostly separate.
Yeah.
It's kind of the gist of it. It's sort of like a, you get a lot of like the separation of church and state from kind of like this kind of doctrine. It's got to be like the church should do churchly things. States should do stately things. There might be limited instances of overlap or intersection, but for the most part, you know, Christians should just kind of, you know, it's kind of like an isolationist approach to Christianity. And insofar as, again, I think it's kind of what Stephen Wolfe is criticizing, and I kind of agree with that criticism. And I actually like the idea of kind of what, you know, Kuiperianism can be described more as like a, it's not a two kingdom, it's a comprehensive kingdom view. There's a statement by Abraham Kuyper, it's on the back of this book here. It says, Christ declares mine over every square inch of creation. And there's something about that that I think is just right. Like Christ, so this has like been going around after the whole Candace Owens saga. People keep on online saying, Christ is king, Christ is king. And, you know, I'm like, yes, he is.
Canceled right now. I didn't know you hated Jewish people.
Right.
Right. I'm sorry, we're derailing. Continue on the Kuiper, but I do want to bring that up. I want to ask what you're
saying. Yeah, it'll tie together and you can ask any follow up. So, yes, Christ is king. And I would say then the logical conclusion from that is because Christ is king, there is no other king but Christ. That's where we get the Christian anarchist mantra, no king but Christ. And so what does it mean then to live for Christ's kingdom? What does it mean to advance Christ's kingdom here on earth? Anytime the gospel is preached, God's kingdom is advanced. Anytime someone comes to faith, God's kingdom is advanced. Anytime that we feed the poor or clothe those who need shelter or stand up for, you know, the least of these in our society, as Jesus said, which is done unto him, the kingdom of God is advanced. Christians do need to be engaging the world, and we should be trying to transform the world for Christ. But we do so in the example that Christ gave us, which was not through wielding of the sword.
Yeah.
Jesus told Peter, if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. We do not, and what is that, the other passage? We don't fight against flesh and blood, but spirits and principalities and heavenly places. And so we have to engage the world, but ultimately understand we're fighting a spiritual battle, not a physical battle. We need to not be trying to use force to coerce people to be more righteous, because that's the opposite of what the Bible tells us. Bible is basically, again, as I said before, the story of how God gave a people a law and said, follow it, and they couldn't. They needed a savior.
Yeah.
We need to bring people to Christ. Let Christ transform them. Let Christ remove the sin from their heart. As Ezekiel says, to take out that heart of stone and give them a heart of flesh. And then we need to try to, this is actually, you know, in some ways we need to adopt the strategy the left took, which is the left didn't take control of the state first. The state dominated culture. Sorry, the left dominated culture. The left had the powerful influences in the institutions and whatnot. And so, listen, I think Christianity should be leading culture, but it needs to be Christianity. It has to be Christ-centered. And so that means that, you know, we do so again through that through the model of our how we serve the world. And it's through our service to the world that we will transform it for Christ. And then because politics is downstream of culture, you know, governments and whatnot will be transformed by that as a consequence. But if we try to put the cart before the horse and try to, you know, force government and force the law, force the norms of society to be Christian before people are Christian, as we see throughout biblical history and world history, both ancient and contemporary, it does not work. But basically the Christian nationalists are basically saying, but maybe this time
it'll work.
Right. Like you said, true Christian nationalism just hasn't been tried yet.
I had a conversation with a friend of mine, and he was like, why do you think a lot of Christians don't enter into politics? And I think the same reason there's not a lot of hardcore Christians entering the politics is because I think it's the same reason why a lot of business people don't enter into politics. They're fine doing their thing, often their own little thing, you know, not bother anybody. They have their church, they have their family. But there's that story in the Bible of Joseph where he gets sold off by his brothers, and he just goes from one situation to another situation. And all he does is just try to stay true to God and who God created him to, you know, telling people dreams that they're having and, you know, not sleeping with the guy's wife, you know, all of this. And then he ends up being way high up in the political sphere. It's almost as if, you know, you or me, all of a sudden we just participate as our Christian life, and lo and behold, next thing we know, you know, it's chair of whatever, you know, vice president or whatever, and in that process able to actually save his family and be an example unto his brothers. I think about that as a great example of how Christians should participate in politics. I don't think they should stop from entering in. I just think go into politics and be true to exactly what that is without having an agenda outside of I'm gonna tell the truth when the truth needs to be said. And I'm going to do the best I can with that. Now, my second thing is the Christian nationalism. Did you watch the Jordan Peterson interview with Destiny?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Do you remember that there's this phenomenal part where they're talking about, I think he's talking about force and how the only way we understand things is through force. And he's like, the church is the same thing as the government. And Peterson's like, well, they don't lock people up. It's like, they don't kill people with an army. And he just lists all these things about what the church does that is not like the state. And I thought that was a great understanding, and timely too, because it came out like last week. Timely to understand this Christian nationalism thing. All the things he pointed to Destiny, he did that in refute to saying the church is better than the state, and here's why. And his whole big thing lately is any idea that needs to be forced is probably a bad idea. The only good ideas, people come to them voluntarily. And I think that's what makes Christianity above all other religions stand out the best, because it's through voluntary acts of service, through voluntary to pick up your cross and carry it with Christ, not to be forced to carry it. Only one person got forced to carry a cross. The rest of them, we get to pick up with us, you know, like, and that's, I think that's a good explanation of how Christianity should always be looked at. So this idea of Christian nationalism seems so asinine to me, but it, on an emotional surface level, when they're, you know, drag story hour in every library, and every time you turn around, the president's coming out with Trans Day of Visibility on Easter, I understand why people are getting emotional.
I do too.
And I feel that. But out of all times right now would be to gird up your loins, as Job would do, and pay attention and be very weary about cursing God and dying, or, you know, whatever that would be, which leads to my, oh, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to touch on that, listen, there is something very wrong about what's going on with this woke ideology and sort of the, you know, gender-affirming care agenda that's being pushed on children. And what I am not saying, again, just like I would agree with Stephen Wolf, who criticizes the evangelicals that basically say, well, yeah, that's wrong, but we can't do anything really except just kind of take it and just, you know, pray for them, pray for our kids. Like, no, we don't have to be passive. I'm not a pacifist, by the way, but I always hate when people equate, like, because even pacifism doesn't even say to be passive, because the root of pacifism is to pacify.
Yeah.
And although I'm not like a pure pacifist, like I'm not against defensive force. I would say that ultimately the Christian's goal should not be to do anything in sort of a mindset of winning, but rather it should be to, what are we called to do? To be peacemakers. So, right. So that should be our heart, right? Our heart shouldn't be like victory or domination of our enemy. It should be peace, and it should be reaching, you know, those who are persecuting us. We should be praying for them, speaking what is true, and hoping that, you know, that they can be brought to the truth of the gospel. But what we do then practically, well, first of all, we have to understand how this problem happened. And I mean, this problem is a creation of the state.
Right.
It cannot be solved by the state. The state is incentivized at this point to create a class of people that are dependent on it at every level. So they're creating a class of people who are, you know, educated in public education, which is like miseducation, which is like making them like mindless drones. Yeah. And so they kind of rely on state programs and institutions. And then I would also say that there's a greater agenda beyond just this, you know, woke trans one, to make a class of people who are dependent upon sort of like the healthcare wing of what's essentially the state at this point. Because, I mean, people don't realize, but after the Affordable Care Act, our healthcare is essentially nationalized in every sense except in name. and the pharmaceutical companies are a big part of that. And so essentially, we're trying to create a class of people who are mindless drones and are enslaved to state institutions and reliant on pharmaceuticals and drugs and different. That's why,
for a lifetime. You know, for a lifetime.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so the way to combat this is not through trying to wield that power back in the opposite direction. Just like in Lord of the Rings, the way to defeat Sauron was not like, well, what if we just take the ring and use it against him?
But that was a constant theme throughout it. Everyone seemed to be drawn to, and it's almost, I mean, Tolkien was right on that. It's not as if we're unaware of how intriguing that is, that power to take the state. But if you look at it in that aspect, every time we need to take power, if it's our turn to take power, every time in the book, it's like, this is not, it never goes well. And you know it right off the bat, because Gandalf tells you, it's like, this, I cannot touch this, because he knew even him, Gandalf, you know, the gray, would have turned evil instantly. And that's the point. I love that analogy, because it's such a good point when it comes to power in the state. You know, let me wield it. I mean, Boromir was right. Like, we could defeat the... We've been holding back the walls. Anyway, I'm not going to go into Lord of the Rings real quick. But yeah, it's a great analogy.
It's a great... And Tolkien was essentially an anarchist in his writings. Yeah. He said, I don't think he was like a full Rothbardian anarchist, but he wrote at one point that my political beliefs were essentially, you know, more and more as time goes on, leading towards anarchy. And I think that plays out in his, you know, in his... world, the world he built, the story he wrote in Middle Earth, in Lord of the Rings, and yeah, like, we cannot. So the solution then in our world is, well, ultimately, one, I would say, homeschool your kids, get your kids out of public schools immediately, and opt out of as many state institutions as you can, and protect your kids. Now, what do you do about the ones that can't get out? Well, no one is saying do nothing. You can get involved at the local level and combat this stuff. I have no issue with, even at the state level, like with people like DeSantis basically, like, you know, saying you can't teach this stuff in schools. Like, there's no, other than maybe teachers losing their jobs, like, there's no compulsion there. And that can be, again, like, if they were teaching just, like, bad economics, I wouldn't say the state should get involved there. When you start teaching things that are harmful, well, yeah, there can be a case to be, you know, like where they're like, you know, especially towards kids, because kids can't consent. They're not fully functioning, fully realized self-owners. By the way, this is going to be something that self-ownership and how that relates to kids is a very important topic. And I'm going to be doing a podcast with who I mentioned earlier, Carrie Baldwin. We're going to be covering this in May. We're working on, getting the details of that hashed out right now, but in May we're going to be doing a deep dive on this because it's a really important topic. It's a really important topic because libertarians and Christians are struggling to come up with the right rhetorical answers to explain why this is wrong and then why it is justified to use, again, appropriate reciprocal, you know, force and civil authority to stop it. While also, I would say, just the ultimate goal then needs to be not just damage control, but the dismantling of these power structures that are ultimately wielded in one direction, and they're not wielded in the direction of virtue. They're not wielded in the direction of you know, aligning society along God's norms and among natural law. But again, because the state, this is why, you know, and I want to be charitable to my libertarian, monarchist, and constitutional, conservative Christian brothers and sisters, but this is ultimately why I fall down on the side of the Christian anarchists, because I think the state is fundamentally, by its very nature, to create a state, a distortion of natural law.
Right.
A distortion of God's law and idolatrous. And I think that a good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit.
Right.
So if you start off with something distorting natural law, you know, the ultimate ends of that are bad outcomes. It doesn't mean I'm all for, you know, we have to do something. I'm all for decentralizing and rolling things back. We need to be moving in that direction. The closer we get to natural law, the better. But we definitely can't say the solution is to further distort natural law, and to be like, well, we just need to do the same thing. We need to control the minds of the youth through a public indoctrination system and a state system of using the power of the sword to crack down on wrong think and to crack down on people we disagree with, mainly because I just don't think it doesn't work, and also
it's proven to not work.
It's proven to just be creating the means of our own destruction. Like, we are in this position now because Christians used these same powers in the interest of their worldview decades ago. And the left hijacked them. And it's like, so what? So this is the ring of power analogy is the perfect one. The only solution is to throw it away. And then without those, the Christian nationalists will say, well, you can't eliminate power, you know, like power and statism, and these things will always exist. Well, I mean, in biblical times, that wasn't true. I would say that the emphasis needs to be start with your community.
But like, hold on, going back to that point where the state is always going to exist. And my response would be, and what does that have to do with the kingdom of God? What does that have to do with the gospel? Oh, well, states are always going to exist. The poor and will always be here with us.
Yep.
It's not the rumors of wars and wars. It's all the way to the end of the book too, bro. Like, it's not like it's going to stop. And so my point is like, and that's my question. And okay, what does that have to do with what I read in this book, the person that Jesus tells me to be? And that is my answer.
There's always an opportunity cost. We can fill our time with fighting over these power structures, or we can fill our time with actually doing what the Great Commission tells us to do.
Yeah.
Where Jesus said, you have up to this point, you know, only fished for you know that in the sea, but follow me and I will teach you to be fishers of men. And that's what we're called to be. And I think if we do that, especially if we do that in our communities, then we can at least make our communities safe, right? Yeah. And if churches are doing that across the nation, across the globe, that's going to do a lot more for protecting kids and for dismantling these problems than short-sighted grasps for power that ultimately only result in short-term wins. And so ultimately, I think, you know, time preference and a bit of like an economic calculation comes in here. It's like we have limited time, and any time we spend not spreading the gospel, I think is probably a failure of weighing out the opportunity costs of our actions. Again, things we can do on the margin at the local level. You know, go on your school board, get in your city council, insofar as you know, certain governors are going to push legislation down on schools. I wouldn't say we should, like, I don't know, like, fight them on that, but also, like, don't put your hope in that.
Yeah.
Don't put your hope in a politician to save you from this woke left insanity, because ultimately that'll fail. That'll ultimately let you down. You know, and also recognize that there's nothing new under the sun. It's not like Jesus gave teachings in the Bible and then it was like, oh, but I wasn't thinking about you living in 2024 right? America and all this woke insanity. Like, this doesn't work for that. Like, no, yeah. Like, I mean, the Romans had all sorts of sexual perversions that they pushed in their culture. It's, you know, there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
And so we have to take a view that is more based in God's kingdom, right? Which is not of this world. And we have to realize that our goal, you know, our commitment is to our families, our communities, and to advancing God's kingdom.
I agree. You know what, Jacob? I think that's 100%. And actually, I think that's a great way to end this, a solutionary advice. Let's end the conversation here. Will you tell everybody where they can find you, what you want them to look for, where you want them to go, any of that stuff?
Yeah, of course. So you can find me, if you want to find the Libertarian Christian Institute, I'll start there. You can go to libertarianchristians.com. LCI creates a lot of great content, articles, and books. We have this book right here behind me, Faith Seeking Freedom, is kind of our main flagship book. It's a libertarian Christian answers to tough questions. So if you're a Christian and you're kind of like, I don't know if I'm about libertarianism, or you're interested in libertarianism but you have questions about things we didn't talk about here, that book covers like probably 80-90% of the common questions that people have.
That's awesome.
About libertarianism from a Christian perspective. So I definitely recommend that. You can find the work I do specifically for LCI at biblicalanarchypodcast.com, where you'll find all the episodes that I do. And then you can also find me on social media. Mainly I'm active on X, or formerly known as Twitter, and that's at Biblical Anarchy, like it says there on my little tag on the bottom of the screen there. And yeah, I would also, as it pertains to this subject, I would heavily recommend that people go back on the Libertarian Christian Institute's YouTube page, and it should be on the website too, but look for the podcasts we did around July of last year that were focused on Christian nationalism. Especially, we did a breakout session at Freedom Fest on Christian nationalism, did like an hour presentation on it, took some Q&A,
nice.
And although the audio quality is not the best, it's good enough that you can trudge through it. And I would definitely recommend people go check that out. And yeah, I appreciate you having me on, man. It was a blast. And
it was a great conversation. I'm glad I got to talk about this.
Hope I was able to give some answers to some people. Because yeah, I mean, I think Christian nationalism is a, you know, just like any ideology that, you know, like even, and I talked about this in a recent podcast episode of mine, people get caught up in bad ideologies for good reasons.
A
lot of these bad ideologies are often in the form of correctly identifying a problem which resonates with people, and then misapplying the solution, you know, and prescribing bad solutions. And so Christian nationalism is not unique in that sense. It correctly identifies certain problems in society, in culture, and with Christians, but it definitely misses the mark in terms of offering solutions, especially in offering what I would say are biblical, Christ-centered solutions.
Yeah, I think this is a really inept phrase, that the good intentions of Christian nationalism pave squarely straight to hell.
Yes.
That's the thing that I think about. Man, I appreciate this conversation. Again, I've been wanting to have this. Thank you so for much. Thank you so much for coming up. I can't do this Christian national. If I have to say the word Christian nationalism one more time, I'm going to throw my computer across the room.
If you say it five times in front
Nick
of a mirror, Nick Fuentes
shows up. Right? We need blasphemy laws. Get away! Get away! Anyway, dude, I loved having this conversation. Thank you so much, man. All right, everybody. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Pardonal Podcast. I'm glad I finally got to hash that out. Kept talking about it on the live episode, or the live podcast, which is on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. I'm rarely on time, but I do show up. Check that out, Pardonable Live, Sunday nights, 8 p.m. Thank you for tuning in. Like and subscribe. Share this around, especially if you're Christian and you got some Christian people asking me, like, what is all this Christian nationalism thing they keep talking about on Morning Joe? Boom, send them this podcast. Anyway, hope you guys have a wonderful week. Love y'all, and stay safe, and read your Bible. Good Lord, read your Bible. All right.